Hi again, Medical Education Podcast listeners. This is Kevin Neva, the editor-in-chief of the journal, coming to you today from a very dark and exceptionally rainy Vancouver day, unfortunately. But my day and yours is about to be brightened because I have the opportunity now to speak with Liz Malloy, who is a professor of work integrated learning in the School of Medicine at the University of Melbourne. And we're going to be speaking about a paper that she and her co-author, Margaret Bierman, have coming out in the January 2019 State of the Science issue. Many of you will know and might have heard the other podcast that's coming out around that month that the deputy editors and I have decided to dedicate this particular State of the Science issue to tensions in medical education or things that make the challenges that we grapple with particularly difficult, as there are issues that pull people or things or ideas in multiple directions and therefore cause ongoing challenges. The paper that Liz and Margaret have contributed to that issue is entitled Embracing the Tension Between Vulnerability and Credibility, Intellectual Candor in Health Professions Education. Liz, thank you for the effort it took to write this paper, first and foremost, and for taking the time to chat with me about it today.
It's a pleasure. Thank you, Kevin. Thanks for having me.
I will maybe disclose that we were way late for a few minutes as you had a fire alarm go off just as we started, but you seem to have recovered and found a quiet space, so hopefully there's no more distractions.
No, that's right. I'm still puffing slightly, but I've managed to grab a broom cupboard in the library, so I've excused myself from the fire drill because we've got more important matters to attend to.
Right. Yeah. As long as it's truly just a drill.
Yeah.
It in many ways speaks to the issue of vulnerability, though, but not in the way that you intended in this paper. Maybe we'll start there, though. If you don't mind, vulnerability is obviously a commonly used term, but what forms of vulnerability were you worried about in taking on this challenge?
Yeah, this is an issue close to my heart and has been the subject of a lot of my research around feedback in the workplace. And I think what has come out very clearly from our research on feedback is that educators are often asking their learners to be very vulnerable, to disclose their deficits, to think about what they need to work on. And yet, on the other side of the table, they're presenting themselves as knowledgeable experts that can help guide the learner. So you sort of see this asymmetry. And I think what was really noticeable in my PhD data set around feedback was the educators that managed to create this, and not necessarily a safe space, but some sort of human space that enabled the learners to be more self-disclosing. The way they did that was actually by self-disclosing, taking risks themselves. So that was sort of the, if you like, the seed for my own interest in this area. And then I've been very fortunate over the last 10 years to work with my colleague and good friend, Margaret Bierman, co-teaching in postgraduate courses in health professions education and also working in simulation, which I think, interestingly, is often about trying to lower the stakes so that people can take healthy risks in their learning and their development. So sort of the combination of the data sets and those worlds, I think, got Margaret and I interested in this idea of vulnerability, but also this sort of very real tension between being vulnerable and also credibility.
And actually, so thinking about that tension in particular, is it credibility on the part of the students who are trying to demonstrate their clinical skill development, or credibility on the part of the educator who feels the need to maintain that guise of being a knowledgeable expert, or reality being a knowledgeable expert as the circumstances might require?
Yeah, so it's both. It's interesting. Prior to this paper, we wrote a short piece in Medical Teacher, which we called Intellectual Streaking. And with that notion of intellectual streaking, which is similar to candor, we talked about the value of teachers exposing their minds and hearts and what that might do to encouraging learners to be more candid or exposing in the name of learning. So that first paper was really focusing on the educator's vulnerability, but this particular paper that we're talking about actually addresses that credibility-vulnerability tension both for the teacher and the learner.
And you mentioned a few individuals in your earlier research, or at least some portion of individuals, who seem to be more willing to take the risk and disclose their own vulnerability. Have you been able to gain much insight in terms of what is it that enables some people to feel more free to do that?
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because I think what interests me about this topic is that if you think about that sweet spot between vulnerability and credibility, and we talk about it as a balance point, it's not fixed within person. So probably you and I have a, you know, what makes me feel vulnerable will be different to what makes you feel vulnerable. But also what makes me feel vulnerable today, doing a podcast at this particular time after a fire alarm, might be different to how I feel at 3 o'clock this afternoon. So I think what is really interesting about this notion is that it's highly situated, and it does depend on the person, but also the context, the stakes of practice or learning, and the individuals that they're interacting with. But I suppose I do get a sense from watching, we've done a lot of observational work of educators and students right across the expertise spectrum in those feedback conversations. And I do think that some people are better at it than others about, yeah, I suppose, thinking on the fly, co-constructing knowledge as they speak. And in a very broad brush way, it's almost like they're prepared to show their fallibility. And there's something in that act of taking the risk that invites, I think, the other person or the other party to reciprocate. Most of us in discussion, whether we're having a coffee with someone or we're in some sort of formal educational situation, we sometimes get a sense of being with people that make us feel like our true good selves, and that we're more prepared to sort of take intellectual risks with those people.
And part of the reason I ask is I can imagine situations where one's credibility might actually be enhanced by virtue of demonstrating their own vulnerability, but that doesn't seem to be the most common reaction when, at least I in previous circumstances, have spoken with some individuals about the culture of medicine, whether we're talking educationally or clinically. And so I wonder if I might ask you to say a bit more, too, about if there are particular circumstances when credibility and vulnerability actually align.
Yeah, I think it's a really great question, and I think typically in the literature we see the focus around if you expose your tender underbelly to another and that doesn't come across well, that your credibility is dashed. And I think what is interesting about credibility is it's not something that we can control. So I can't control my credibility. Credibility is something that is attributed to me by others. And we all know that feeling that if you go and give a conference presentation, for example, we quite like to be prepared, we like to have some slides, we might have a slide at the end of our deck when you give me a curly question that I can say, well, that's a good question, Kevin. Let me just scroll to my end slide and I'll show you this graph that illustrates that very point. So we prepare very, very vigilantly and diligently in order to prevent this loss of face. But I suppose what we do see in action, and we see it in the classroom and in the workplace, I think, around workplace teaching, that when people are prepared to walk that tightrope and they're prepared to take this sort of risk where they might fall, that's often where the magic happens. And I know myself, it's when people turn off the PowerPoint projector or they speak from the heart or they tell an anecdote or they add something in spontaneously, that sort of improvisational quality, that's often when we get the resonance and more potent learning experiences.
And you speak in the paper about ritualized interactions and how they are often used to help one try to maintain credibility. Is that the sort of thing that you mean to be a break from a ritualized interaction? That it's no longer people going through the motions? Or how does credibility relate to doing those things that are more deeply embedded in any culture?
Yeah, so I think if you think about ritualized interactions like a lecture or a formal feedback session where you sit down face-to-face with a student and a teacher, there are sort of assumptions about how the process is going to unfold. There are assumptions about who holds the power. If I'm a clinical supervisor and I have an assessment form alongside the feedback discussion, that creates a certain ritual. And it is our sort of strategic learners and teachers that understand those rituals and read the situation, and based on that appraisal, people often decide how much they'll reveal or the extent to which they're wanting to show their best shiny self to achieve an outcome. And I think what we're saying in this paper, and we've used some theories that perhaps shine a different light on this around transformative learning and also Goffman's idea about face, that if we disrupt these rituals, that's when we can perhaps get some more powerful learning. So things that reduce power asymmetry or even sort of the formal nature of interactions can have good effects. So an example we use in the paper is in conferences or in classroom teaching, often the expert gets up the front, talks through their slides, and then there'll be a time for questions. And if people have the courage, they'll stand up at the microphone, line up with their heart pounding, ready to ask their question or to start their monologue. That's a ritual that affords certain sorts of information exchange that can often be quite predictable. Whereas if you disrupt that with something like a spongy microphone that you can throw around the room, a microphone cube, it creates a very different sort of interaction where people are more spontaneous, people can sort of chip into the argument, it can be thrown back to the teacher, back to the peers. And that to me is quite exciting. It allows people perhaps to be more candid, but maybe less vulnerable because they're not standing up in front of a full room at the microphone. That tends to engender certain expectations.
Well, and so how does that lead to the notion of intellectual candor, and how have you defined that as a potential path forward?
Yeah, so I suppose we present intellectual candor as this way to negotiate the tension between vulnerability and credibility, but also to embrace it. And I think so often we talk about, you know, let's dissolve the tension or let's fix the tension. But what we're trying to say in this paper, and I hope we get our point across, is that these are sort of facets and experiences that we may not be able to change. But through intellectual candor, which we define as this idea that you're prepared to expose yourself, your inner workings of your mind or your deficits in order to enhance your own learning and the learning of others. And I think that definition is important because of, you know, we've been testing the market, we've been presenting at conferences and various educational interactions in the last few months. And when we bring up this notion of intellectual candor, often people say, oh, I don't really want to hear someone indulging as a form of catharsis and telling us their sort of inner problems. You know, that what value does that give to me apart from making me feel hot and itchy and uncomfortable?
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I think it's really important to go back to that definition and present this idea that you'd only be intellectually candid if you feel like there's going to be a benefit in terms of the learning outcomes.
Well, and importantly, I was particularly struck by the notion of a dual benefit of promoting learning and others learning, right? It sounds like this is really being built around the humility that even the educator has something to learn by demonstrating where the gray areas are in one's understanding or abilities.
That's right. So if you think about, and again, it's sort of a fairly gross analogy, but if you think about presenting a conference paper with pre-prepared slides, often there's nothing new that you're going to generate from that. But if you come in with some dot points and interact with the audience, take on their questions and propose ideas, as the teacher, you're learning because the very act of co-construction means that you're giving up something or you might be acquiescing a prior viewpoint for new information that comes in. And that new information might have been generated by your peers or by your learners or your patients in the example of clinical practice, but it also might be generated through you thinking aloud and thinking on the run. And to me, that's sort of the jewel of intellectual candor, that co-construction of knowledge in the moment.
And you include a lot of details in the paper on thoughts around strategies for promoting intellectual candor and features of it, along with some of the potential benefits and limitations. And I don't think we should take the time in this forum to go through all those, but just did want to highlight as a way of closing that it strikes me as very powerful that you have presented these ideas as a way of saying we aren't trying to and probably can't get rid of the tension altogether. It's something that we will naturally feel and experience, but that this might help one to grapple productively in that state of tension. And so I'll just ask if you have any closing thoughts in terms of what advice you would provide to somebody to help them stay in that sweet spot you described.
Yeah, I mean, I think modeling is so important. And when you ask that question about does this notion apply to learners or teachers, I think it is to both. But I do think that teachers or senior people in the profession are in a really good position to model this idea about intellectual risk-taking. And in a sense, it's easier because they've got more credibility, they've got more in the bank, and perhaps they can afford to take those risks. But it is, I think, as a learner, when you watch someone and when you're engaging with someone who's prepared to be human and open themselves up to possibility, then perhaps that's quite a persuasive rationale for, okay, this is the outcome and here might be some ways to go about it. So I think, you know, modelling is important. And then from a curriculum design point of view, there are some very clear things we can do to try to engender this idea of intellectual candour. Margaret and I are working with a PhD student, Julia Harrison, at the moment from Monash University. And Julia's PhD is around the pedagogy of fallibility. And, you know, I think there are some very similar or overlapping principles in Julia's work about how do you create doctors who are prepared to be fallible and prepared to be reflective in order to keep their own development going, and even from a patient safety point of view, are prepared to be reflective and change what they do. So I think part of that curriculum design is creating enough space for people to be a little bit playful within the curriculum, and I think we can do that through things like role play and simulation. In the paper we talk about disrupting rituals within the classroom and the workplace, and obviously that's not during high stakes work, but on the fringes when you can sort of take more risks, I think it's important that we give students enough space to play and to experiment. You know, if you enact certain things and you access certain types of knowledge, what are the results? And I think part of the idea of intellectual candour is to actually trace the effects of your risk-taking on your own knowledge and on the knowledge of others. So, you know, we're not encouraging people to blindly take this up as a strategy, but to actually experiment with it and to see what the outcomes are.
Which alone is another form of making oneself vulnerable, right? Just checking in on the extent to which one is impacting upon their credibility and trying to adjust on the fly as things evolve in unexpected ways. So I think it's a really interesting, you know, multi-layered challenge that you've put before us, and I encourage those who are interested in thinking about and grappling with this challenge further to go find the paper that we've been discussing, authored by Liz Malloy, entitled Embracing the Tension Between Vulnerability and Credibility, Intellectual Candor in Health Professions Education, and you'll find it in the January 2019 issue of Medical Education. Thanks very much, Liz. I look forward to seeing this come out and seeing the rest of your follow-up work.
Great. Thank you, Kevin. Thanks for having me, and I'm glad I'm not so puffed.
You sound just fine. Excellent. Yep. Thanks very much.
Thank you.